We really have very specific things that we're looking for when we review submissions and talk to potential authors about what they're thinking. And the first one is, what is new? Obviously, we want it to be in a really important space, like, for example, AI right now. But how does this article advance the conversation and what is it building on? Secondly, is it narrow enough to lead to very actionable results?
Abby Lundberg is the editor-in-chief at MIT Sloan Management Review, among the top publications that focus on strategic business leadership and management issues. Given the glut of free information in today's internet age, finding and publishing fresh thinking on leadership, digital innovation, and sustainable business can be quite challenging. With over 40 years in publishing, Abby is well-equipped to lead MIT Sloan Management Review. Previous to joining MIT Sloan Management Review, she was a contributing editor at Harvard Business Review's Analytics Services, an HBR business unit that researches and analyzes key business management trends and emerging market opportunities. She's also run her own consultancy, which provided research, writing, and presentation services to C-level execs. In this episode of Everything Thought Leadership, Abby and I discuss the sweet science of translating great ideas into top-notch thinking suitable for publication as august as MIT Sloan Management Review. MIT Sloan Management Review's process for determining whether to proceed with an article pitch or unsolicited article submission. MIT Sloan Management Review's editorial process from ideation through publication. The editorial guidelines that cover the growing use of generative AI in generating thought leadership, and the future of thought leadership publishing. So Abby, thanks for joining us today on Everything Thought Leadership.
Happy to be here.
So why don't we start with a little bit of your past. You started on the consumer side of publishing way back when, of course, before moving to the trades and academic journals. Can you maybe just give us a little perspective on what prompted that shift?
So I worked in New York on a couple of different media companies. And I started out editing Hints from Heloise and Dr. Joyce Brothers and a gossip column from LA. I was working for King Feature Syndicate. And, you know, that was fun for a while, but it's only so many ways you can get ink stains out of clothes. So my shift really had to do with, you know, and I think, Alan, you can relate to this. One of the reasons I became a journalist was because I love learning new things. And I figured that this would be a skill set that I could transfer from one domain to another. And so that was my thinking when I joined CIO Magazine at IDG. I thought, well, I'd be there maybe 5 years. But what happened in the technology leadership space was that every 5 years, something changed dramatically. And so it just kept being fresh and interesting and engaging for quite a while. And when I left there, I started my own business and I had a bunch of different clients, including, as you mentioned, HBR Analytics Services. But I was also doing some communication consulting to CIOs for their internal communications and external communications. I was very happy working for myself. I did that for 12 years. But when this job at MIT Sloan Management Review came along, it was just, I hadn't really been thinking that I would take another full-time job. But it was such a perfect fit. The editing that they were doing, I had done some editing for them on a contract basis, and getting back to working with really smart people on their ideas and helping them develop their ideas for being able to put those into practice was really, I loved the experience. And then this position opened up and it was just, it was a perfect fit for in terms of my experience and skills and the challenges of the job and what it had to offer. So that's how I ended up at SMR.
It's funny that you said I could relate to this because I was thinking back as you were explaining your career trajectory. I started my career as a journalist, of course, and I was writing about sports and politics and arts and entertainment. And I saw this opportunity that was listed, I think, in the New York Times classified section, which is where we all got our job leads in those days, for a reporter position at a publication called Electronic News, which was published by Fairchild Publications. And I didn't really know much about electronics. I didn't even know that much about business. And I went and did the interview, and I looked around the newsroom, and I saw all these older men, all in white shirts with pocket savers, you know, with their calculators and their, you know, their pens in there. And I said, I don't think I fit in this organization. But they gave me a writing test, and wouldn't you know it, they offered me the job. And I became smitten with technology and learned a lot about business along the way, which is I've profited from both professionally and personally, of course. And I got so into technology. And as you noted, the technology trends, the cycles, every 5 years, they change. And I had to reinvent myself every 5 to 7 years as well to keep pace. So it's been a long run for me following technology and now being a consultant on thought leadership to help, you know, people to establish their thinking and present their best and their brightest on a topic. And it's been very rewarding, I have to say. I don't really worry about bylines anymore. I'd much rather be more or less kind of a conduit for getting good stories told. Anyway, so you've worked for a number of prestigious publications. You mentioned IDG and CIO Magazine and HBR, and now you're at MIT Sloan Management Review. How do they differ? And how have you evolved as an editor to meet the ever-changing informational needs of your audience?
CIO was a unique place when I was there because the CIO position hadn't really existed up to that point. There were probably a handful of people with that title. And our job was to champion those professionals and to help them establish themselves as business leaders, not just technology leaders. So we really had an advocacy role. As the years went on, we shifted a little bit away from that advocacy role to be a little bit more hard-hitting, especially around like the year 2000 and moving into the internet age. There was so much at stake with the work that CIOs were responsible for. So we saw our mission shifting a little bit then to be more one of saying, okay, you know, this is your job. You need to be accountable. So we did some stories that we would not have done in the early days in terms of just being a little bit more investigative and a little bit harder hitting, both within the CIO community, but also within the vendor community. And then the shift over to, I guess, so the shift for me was really away from the CIO IT leadership area into a broader leadership area when I started working with HBR Analytics Services and then also obviously at Sloan Management Review. In terms of the focus and the editorial approach, at SMR, we have a very rigorous approach to making sure that the ideas that we're presenting to the world are in fact novel and useful for managers trying to help their companies be successful.
It's interesting. Why don't we talk a lot about Sloan Management Review and the editorial mission and your role as a thought leadership journal? I mean, you've made it very clear in your mission statement that you guys want to lead the discourse among influential thought leaders on a world being transformed by technological, societal, and environmental change. And your focus, of course, is on leadership and management issues. The term thought leader, as you know quite well, is thrown around very loosely these days.
I always do like the air quotes.
Yeah. So can you define what you guys mean by thought leader? And can you kind of tell us what you think makes for a great thought leader?
Absolutely. We really have very specific things that we're looking for when we review submissions and talk to potential authors about what they're thinking. And the first one is, you know, what is new? And it could be in a really, obviously, we want it to be in a really important space, like, for example, AI right now. But how does this article advance the conversation and what is it building on? So that's the first one, is novelty or newness of the ideas. And then secondly, is it narrow enough to lead to very actionable results to be able to tell somebody what they can do next? Obviously, it's got to be relevant to managers. What is the urgent problem that's helping them to address? For us, we really want to see, and this is where we're a little bit, I think it's a differentiator for us from some other publications, is what is the evidence that these recommendations are based on? You know, is there new research? How do the authors make their case? And then finally, does the author have established credibility in the topic? You know, that's obviously something that we would want to see.
For sure. So it comes down to, you know, the essential relevance of the idea, the topic, breakthrough thinking, how deep you go, making it narrow, making it actionable. Those are all great attributes of a good piece. Can you talk a little bit about how you really take stock of what a pitch is and try to distill it and try to project as to what that article could and should be? I mean, you get a lot of submissions, obviously, and, you know, some of them probably sound good on paper, but in reality, I know you're looking at the credentials of the person submitting it and whether they've got a pedigree to back what they're wanting to write about. Can you just talk about that process and making sure that when the submission comes in, it's really going to be what you need and what your audience requires to really advance their thinking?
Sure. One thing on the pedigree point, what we do, one of the things that we pride ourselves on is that we look for new thinkers, new sources of ideas. So we're not just going back to the well to the people who are well known in a particular space. Obviously, we want to publish those people who are really highly regarded in a particular area, but we also value our big funnel. And so we do go out and talk to lots of people in different spaces. You know, it's not just the two coasts, it's not just North America. We really look around the globe for those sources.
Once you've determined that an individual has the right stuff, that they've got a breakthrough idea, that they have credentials, that they've thought through and have a breakthrough approach to conceptualizing it and then delivering something actionable, how then do you decide, you know, which, because you've got probably many options on a topic, which authors you go forward with and which ones are going to deliver the goods that you need to serve your audience?
You know, we get over 550 submissions a year, and that's in addition to the acquisition work that we do, doing outreach to people that we know from being previously published with us or that we come across at the Academy of Management events or whatever. So we do have a lot of submissions to sort through. We accept either proposals or drafts of articles. So, you know, obviously the more detail we get in a submission, the easier it is for us to figure out whether or not that's something we want to go forward with. What happens sometimes is that, you know, we get a pretty interesting pitch, but we've just published something on that topic. So that factors into it as well. When we do get to a point of saying, so our process is we actually review submissions together as a team, the editorial team does. We get together once a week and go through all the submissions that have come in that week and anything that's come in over the transom. And then we kind of so there's sort of a desk review where there are obviously going to be some proposals that just aren't a good fit for us and we weed them out, but then we take the rest of them and we divide them up as a team for a more, you know, for a deeper review. So we'll all take a couple of pieces each week to go deeper with. For example, I just had a proposal for a piece that was based on an academic article. They didn't include that in their submission, but I went out and found that article because I had questions about what was the research really, how did they conduct their research? So we do a pretty thorough review at that point. And then what would happen is we would then, if we decided it was interesting, was something we might want to pursue, we would connect with the authors and talk through some issues that might be there, whether it was like, you know, you're positioning this way, but really what it seems like this might be the most relevant piece. Would you think about reframing this or whatever? And we still haven't accepted it at that point. We're still in development of working with authors to get to a point where we can agree that this is right for us. And it's in condition to move forward with real editing.
And I have to say, and I think I told you this previously, that it's nice that you actually submit something into your portal and you get a response, and you get a response fairly quickly. I can't say that about other publications that I've worked with. It's, I know, inundating. You get a lot of requests, and maybe you don't get as many requests as some of these other publications that I referred to in the past to you. But at the same time, the fact that you care enough to come back, and even if it's a no, you'd rather know that it's a no than just be left lingering and wondering as to what has happened. So kudos to you and your team on that one. So another thing that became clear to me in working with some members from your team, and you mentioned this a little bit, is that you're really looking not just for fresh thinking, but for evidence, for fact-based, whether it's new research or research that helps to support the development of a point of view, best case examples, things of that nature. A lot of research out there, of course, and you can probably find a factoid to support anything these days, whether it's real or not. I think you have to do your due diligence, of course. But how do you make sure that the fact basis is really there, that it's watertight, that the evidence is going to help to tell a great story? And that's really important. It's not going to just be a recitation of data. It's going to be a yarn that you're weaving.
Yeah, so we do look at what is the research. Is it based on just a lit review? You know, the authors went and read a bunch of other pieces and drew insights from that. that sort of falls lower on the hierarchy for us. You know, did they conduct actual field research? What was the length of time that they were conducting that research? Another example, just from that piece that I read this week, there was really deep research, very good, solid research on one aspect of what they were saying in their paper, but they drew conclusions from it that were not evidence-based. They speculated why this was happening. And so that ended up being a piece that we were not moving forward with, or we'll talk to the authors about that aspect.
Sure. No, that makes a lot of sense. So once an article is accepted for publication, I understand, and having worked with you guys in the past, that you sign an editor to it and they help shepherd it through the process. Can you kind of discuss the mechanics of that and how long it takes to get something from acceptance into the publication?
So I will actually say that we have two separate but interlinked editorial tracks. So there are the articles that we want to publish in the magazine. The magazine has research features, which are 4,000 word, deeply researched pieces. We also do other kinds of articles that aren't quite so long or meaty. We have different sections of the publication. We just launched a new section called Radar, which is really short pieces, maybe data points, things that we've come across that aren't going to become a full-fledged feature. So that's sort of the magazine process. But then we also have a digital track, so articles that are going to be digital only, and that includes a lot of our columnists, although some of our columns do end up getting into the magazine. And our digital pieces tend to be shorter, 1,200 to 2,000 words. They, you know, typically would focus on some practical takeaways, you know, 5 tips for doing better one-on-ones was one that we did recently. And so it's a little bit different. The expectations are a little bit different, but the teams are integrated. The members of the team do work on both. Although, you know, we have Loria McLaughlin is the senior editor for digital. That's her responsibility. Elizabeth Heichler is the editorial director for the magazine. That's what she's responsible for. But they both do sort of cross over as well.
So in a world where, you know, print has been de-emphasized by numbers of publications and whatnot, you're still publishing a print magazine. You do
quarterly.
A lot of digital too. Yeah, quarterly. So how do you figure out what goes where? I mean, is the print more or less editorially driven by a calendar? Is digital more kind of happenstance or opportunistic, that you're taking interesting, relevant, topical things that you want to get into people's minds quicker? How do you divide that?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to do a calendar when you are publishing, you know, contributed articles, because we're not going out and assigning articles as we did at CIO. So we can't be assured that we will have articles on a particular topic. So what we typically do is we take what's coming in. We're in the process of building up a surplus of articles so that we can have more flexibility for planning around topics, around timing. But timing-wise, it really depends both on, it's less about our schedule and more about the author's schedule. So I know Elizabeth just is wrapping up a piece that's been in the works for 2 years. But that was because the authors were super busy and working on other things, and it's going to be great, but planning for the mix can be challenging. It's getting a little easier. And then we do these things we call special reports in every issue. And that is we find with what we're putting into the magazine, we look for themes. Sometimes the themes are loose, but like the most recent one was on capturing opportunity, so innovation and new markets. We just happen to have 3 pieces come in that were sort of fit into that space.
That's nice. It's great when it works that way. Despite concerns that younger readers and those outside of the elite pockets of the East and West Coasts have turned a blind eye to prestigious publications like MIT Sloan Management Review and Harvard Business Review, among others, we believe they still play a vital role in the thought leadership mix. Consumers of thought leadership appear to agree, according to our latest research conducted with Phronesis Partners and Rattleback. We asked 152 B2B senior executives who consume thought leadership to tell us the most influential piece of thought leadership content that they had seen in the last 5 years that helped convince their organization to select the firm that co-authored the content. Not surprisingly, an article in a management journal scored second best, with 80 respondents selecting this option, right behind a conference or seminar presentation. This finding held true across many of the industries we studied. An article in a management journal was preferred by B2B thought leadership consumers in banking, retail, and high tech. Moreover, long-form articles were ranked first by 14% of the thought leadership consumers who we surveyed, tied with video, podcasts, and live webinars, as well as video conferences. So much for the depth of long-form content. You mentioned AI being really hot now, and you can't go anywhere without reading about AI, good, bad, or ugly. What are the hot topics right now, and which ones in your mind are overpitched and are crying out for no mas, you know, we've seen this bad movie before kind of thing?
Our hot topics, the ones that we're really focusing on right now, are AI. AI is, you know, the one that we get the most demand for, that get the most traffic, both not just Gen AI, but AI broadly. But again, sort of the practical applications and what's really happening out there and how are executives and leaders dealing with it. The second area for us right now is sort of culture in the workforce. We publish a lot on, you know, we've done a series kind of on toxic culture with John Saul, and he's done some tremendous research. He mines Glassdoor data and then runs it through an AI to pull out themes and really, really good stuff. And so we've built a body of content around that. So AI, culture in the workforce, and our third area that we're really focused on right now is sustainable business. And that's not just about sustainability in the sort of climate sense. It's really about, you know, supply chain resilience and cybersecurity, all of the things that make a business sustainable, with, of course, the core sustainability very, very important.
Absolutely. So do you guys use a lot of data analytics to inform your selection process or how the themes evolve or what your readership is really looking for?
Data analytics in terms of what's happening on our website and social media, for sure, absolutely. We look at those numbers all the time. And we've started producing a lot of video now. So we hired a multimedia editor this year. And so we've got the YouTube metrics, the WordPress metrics, or Google Analytics, and our social media metrics. We look at those all the time. That's where when I said AI is the hottest topic, followed by culture in the workforce, that's where we're getting that information from.
Right. So gut instinct is important, but the facts are the facts, and you'd rather let them help to lead you to places where your readers need and want to go.
Yeah. And I will say that sustainability topic is one that is less rising to the surface from a reader demand perspective, but we're going to do it anyway because it's important. Right.
Let's talk a little bit about the evolution of publishing. I mean, clearly, as I said earlier, things are shifting more to digital. I mean, print is still important. Those of us old, mainstay wretches really still love to crawl up and read a good book or a magazine. But I think, you know, reader habits are changing. I mean, at least what I see in the younger crowd, I mean, they just consume most of their content online, and they prefer shorter articles to longer articles, and they prefer to be stimulated with the data viz or concept viz. These are expensive things to do. You said you just hired a multimedia editor, so you've obviously got that religion. But how are you guys managing that transition without blowing out your budget?
That's the key question, isn't it? When I joined, one of my first priorities was to say, look, people want to consume content in different media. There's not one or another. It's not all video. It's not all audio. It's not all print. And we need to provide our audience with our content in whatever format they want to consume it in. So it is an investment to be doing video, for sure. We hope we can support that through sponsorship or advertising revenue. That's something that we're still early in this. It's only been about 6 months. So we're defining what our types of videos are and looking, you know, is this a series that somebody would want to sponsor? So we're in that process right now. We're going to be rolling out audio versions of our articles because we know from reader feedback that some people want to listen to it in their car while they're jogging. We do have a really, really successful podcast, Me, Myself, and AI, that's been going on for a number of years now.
But these would be editorially driven. They would not be advertorials, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, we're closing out our custom publishing business right now. I mean, one of the things that we realized working with Don Sellers, our new faculty advisor, and he's a professor of the practice and strategy at Sloan. One of the things that he's really encouraged us to do is to really focus on our target audience, who are our super fans, and what can we do more for them. And so we're making a little bit of a shift right now to producing different kinds of content that will extend the really terrific high-value content that we're producing now. How can we extend it further and make it even more actionable and practical?
We've talked a lot about AI, and I noticed that you recently added some guidelines around articles written with the assistance of generative AI, and you adapted them from the Committee on Publication Ethics. I looked and they're quite specific. In some, they really require authors to disclose which generative AI tool they used and how they used it. How's that going so far? Have you gotten any pushback? Have you seen any people trying to commit the rules?
What we really want is we want to know if somebody's used Gen AI and how they've used it. I don't really care about the tool. What we say in our guidelines is you can't have AI as a co-author. You are the author. You are accountable for whatever's in here. And so, you know, check your stuff. If you're using AI, make sure that it's solid. We did just add some new fields to our submissions form, which asks specifically, did you use AI in putting together this piece? And if so, in what ways did you use it? So was it brainstorming, headlines? Was it helping with research, whatever?
Have you had any cases where people have tried to use AI and not disclosed it? I mean, there are tools out there, academic tools that are out there that can actually detect whether or not somebody has used generative AI to write a piece of content. And sometimes it's just the sniff test. I'm sure you have come across content before. You say, this doesn't sound like a human being. It sounds like a bot.
Yeah, somebody told me recently, and now I see it more frequently, is if a piece starts out in a world where, I've been seeing that more often. I don't know if it's AI generated, but that is something that AI tends to lead with.
But you haven't had any indication that somebody's trying to use AI and not disclose it to you guys before you have to know before you publish it, obviously.
Yeah, we've heard mixed results on those tools. In fact, I think some of those checker tools have been pulled from the market because they're not very reliable. So it is between the editor and the author to work through the source of their research, how they came up with their ideas, and how they've developed their thinking around a particular topic.
So how do you see the role of generative AI evolving over time? I mean, I see it as a productivity multiplier. You know, it can help to assemble some core facts, test your hypothesis, offer some advice on keeping your writing succinct and tight, crisp, hopefully clear and coherent. But I think you made this point as well. Sometimes they generate fabrications and hallucinations. And you know, you can't outsource good thinking, at least is my view on all of this. But these tools can be helpful to some degree. What's your take?
I just used it yesterday. So I've been playing around with different tools, but I hadn't realized that Claude AI, you can actually put a much larger volume of text into it. I used it to synthesize. We've been conducting calls with our editorial advisory board about these new products that we want to roll out. And so I had these 6,000-7,000 words of notes from people. And I ran it through Claude and it did a beautiful job of pulling things out. I asked it a couple of different ways. I said, you know, what specific new revenue generating ideas came out of this? Or what were the things that were cited most frequently? And did a really nice job. I did then go through all the notes myself to see if it missed anything. And it really actually hadn't. It was amazing.
Well, I mean, baseline, these tools are pretty good. They're only bound to get better, right? But I just think we all have to be very careful in how we use them and not abuse them. Use them responsibly. Use them to the benefit of your audience. You're giving them clearer, more coherent copy. And ultimately, you're fact-checking. Humans need to be in the loop. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, and I can see some of our authors, especially those who are not native English speakers, who might look to an AI for help in sort of how they're phrasing things.
So how do you see thought leadership publishing evolving over time, topically, presentation-wise? Is there anything that you see that's kind of, you're looking out over the horizon and you want to get there, you know, just to keep your readership in the know and as well served as can be?
I think AI is creating a lot of challenges on this front because, you know, if you can go out and query for what are the best 5 tips for doing better one-on-ones, you know, you can get that, all that information's out there somewhere. I think what we're thinking about is how do we have such a great deep body of management knowledge that we've developed over the, you know, decades. How can we use the tool to help our audience get what they want in terms of our content? Because they know our content is trusted and valid and validated. And so that's one of the things that we're thinking about is how can we help our audience to mine our content better versus going out to the big wide world?
Are you concerned at all that your content is used to train some of these large language models, and sometimes what gets lost in translation is the original source of the idea or the supporting context and facts and figures?
Yeah, I mean, we actually had a licensing opportunity to license our content to train another company's LLM. That space is definitely evolving. It's hard to do. It's hard to create that body of knowledge that is validated and is reliable and is, you know, high quality. So I do worry a lot about our authors losing connection to their ideas. You know, those are their ideas. And I hope that the way things evolve in the future is that there will be attribution when LLMs pull up answers and ideas.
Last question. Any advice for budding thought leaders or ghostwriters, editors, graphic artists, or anybody who wants to get on the thought leadership publishing fast track?
Number one, obviously, is know your publication that you're pitching to. You know, spend some time reading it. Think about how they position things. Think about what kinds of content they're producing. And I mean, I think that's really sort of number one. I get pitches all the time that are like, Why do you think that might be an idea for us?
I know. I can remember being an editor and getting pitched and, you know, just pulling my hair out. So why are they even thinking that I would be interested in this? And then years later, I would run into people from the PR community who would say, oh, I remember you. I used to pitch you all the time. I used to always have to say, was I nice to you? You know, I'm afraid of what I would say sometimes because it was so crazy that they would think I'd have any interest in the idea, but so it is.
Yeah, I went back to a PR person last week and said, why do you think this is a good idea for us? And they actually came back with like 5 rationales that I'm like, okay, that actually, isn't, but they, you know, they at least are trying.
I think that's often the exception rather than the rule, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we leave it there? Thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a wonderful conversation, and I look forward to continuing it with you.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks for having me.
In our view, there is no better place to have your best and brightest thinking validated and shared with business leaders and other influencers than having an article published in a prestigious publication like MIT Sloan Management Review. But it's not easy. As Abby noted, MIT Sloan Management Review is looking for fresh thinking on management, leadership, technology innovation, and business culture issues that will resonate with the publication's discerning readers. That's why Abby and her editors are quite selective about what they publish, which means aspiring and time-tested thought leaders and their organizations must put the time and effort to develop truly breakthrough ideas. And as Abby emphasized, these ideas must be grounded in real research and providing tangible recommendations that readers can apply in their own organizations. It was refreshing to hear that the pub is always on the lookout for new thinkers and new sources of ideas. While established experts in key topical areas are still highly encouraged to publish articles, Abby and her editors take pride in speaking with authoritative folks in different spaces. They're looking for thought leaders worldwide. The thought leaders and their thought leadership marketing minions will need to work hard developing the arguments that bring their big ideas to life. Beware, these insights can take time to collect, sift, analyze, and render into prose. And while generative AI opens up a treasure trove of secondary research insights, MIT Sloan Management Review's new publishing guidelines make clear that the use of these tools must be disclosed upfront. And take note, bots cannot be listed as co-authors. Well, that's all for now. Thanks for joining us in Everything Thought Leadership.
If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love it if you'd left a like and share this episode with your colleagues. Everything Thought Leadership is a video and podcast series from Boudet TLP for thought leaders and thought leadership professionals, the people who help experts get recognized as thought leaders. You can find out more about Boudet TLP at boudettlp.com.